This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Now I'm with Elizabeth Colbert, who's been covering climate change for The New Yorker for years. And she's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, about the effects of climate change on Earth. No one knows more about this subject, in my estimation. But I have to tell you, and I've known Betsy for a long time, she's never exactly been a cockeyed optimist about this or any other subject. So now we're coming to the climate negotiations in Paris. They begin November 30th. Everybody's talking about it in the most dramatic terms, as if there's going to be a fantastic breakthrough. Betsy, what are your expectations?
Well, I think that there probably will be an agreement that comes out of Paris. That seems to be the direction we're heading in. As you say, there's a lot of optimism, and I think that there's been so many years. This meeting is being called COP21. Okay, so this is the 21st of these meetings, and there have been one sort of failure after another. So I think if we don't get an agreement, you know, the stakes are so high that people are really, really trying to ensure
But why is this night different from all other nights? We've seen agreements in Kyoto, in Copenhagen, all ballyhooed on the front pages of newspapers, and everybody goes home feeling a little uplifted. President Obama is extremely proud of himself that he broke into a meeting with the Chinese and managed to get some concessions from the Chinese. Meanwhile, the problem gets worse and worse and worse. The weather ramifications are what they are. The political ramifications and the disbelief in climate change persists. Why do you have any belief, or do you have any belief, that Paris is, as we endlessly say now, a game changer of any kind?
Well, that is the $64 trillion question, and I think that there are two things going on here. One of which is, as you say, the physical evidence is just becoming overwhelming, and the world is reaching a critical point of either committing to doing something or throwing up its hands and really letting, the worst happen. And I think there is a sense among world leaders, including, Barack Obama, that something must be done. So in that sense, there is momentum. Now, that being said, I don't think anyone expects that this is going to be, for example, the peak of emissions, right? Are we going to, in 2015, see the highest emissions in history, and then emissions are going to start to decline, which is really what has to happen. That's the only thing that the atmosphere cares about, right, is how much CO2 we're putting up there. But the hope is that we sort of commit to peaking emissions. So, for example, China, as part of its commitment going into Paris, has said it will peak its emissions by 2030. Now, that's still 15 years from now, but that at least is a step in the right direction.
So China seems to be a dilemma here. On the one hand, China seems to have more political momentum than it's ever had to help solve this problem in concert with the rest of the industrialized nations of the world. On the other hand, we pick up the paper the other day and we see that they have been lying like crazy about how much coal smoke has been going up into the atmosphere above China. How would you describe the Chinese political situation when it comes to global warming, their impulse to do something, their capacity to do something, and what they will do.
You know, China is the world's leading emitter by far now. It surpassed the U.S. far earlier than expected and has gone on to, you know, just grow its increase its emissions radically over the last decade or so. With no real end in sight, although they have, you know, said they will peak in 2030, and there are some signs actually that they are leveling out. But that being said, the Chinese system, which ratcheted up really quickly, there's also a sense, well, they could ratchet down really quickly. That's the way they do things. You know, they don't have a Congress sitting there blocking every move when they decide to do something and the order goes out to do it. So that's the hope. How's that? And in terms of, you know, have they been underestimating their emissions, I do want to say that you know, they have been, but that correction came from them, you know. So they are trying and to be more transparent. And transparency is a very big part of going into Paris. You know, can we trust each other?
So the United States and China both have domestic targets now too, right? So what changed?
Well, I think what changed was you know, the Chinese are feeling effects, the U.S. is feeling effects, and we are the two biggest emitters. So you can, you know, deal with this problem if China and the U.S. want to deal with it, and you can't deal with it if they don't want to deal with it. And the U.S. has really dragged its feet, you know, for many, many years. And the agreement that you alluded to at the start, you know, what's called the Copenhagen Accord, which was brokered by Barack Obama, that was considered in many ways a failure. And so now the U.S. is trying to step up to the plate. President Obama just rejected, you know, the Keystone Pipeline. That was very much a move, I think, designed to send a signal to the world that we are serious.
It took him years, though. In other words, Barack Obama is a left-of-center Democrat who came to office committed to doing something about climate change. We are now in year 7 of his presidency. And for the first time, when you talk to people in the State Department, when you talk to people in the White House, they feel that climate change is a legacy issue, but only now.
I think he was a person who was late to come to this as one of the central issues of our time. And it's only now, as you say, in his second term, that he's really started to do the things that he needed to do. In other words, the U.S. is going to come into Paris with something to show, finally, because Barack Obama finally decided to bypass Congress. And I do give him a lot of credit for that, because otherwise we would be going to Paris with nothing and there would be no prospect of an agreement, really, if the U.S. is not taking any concrete action. So
What concrete action is the United States taking?
The concrete action that the U.S. is taking is what are called the Clean Power Plant Rules, and they are a set of regulations designed to limit emissions from power plants, and they will have the practical effect of closing down a lot of the country's least efficient coal electricity generating plants. But there is sort of a sense that we are making progress, which didn't seem to be the case for many years.
In short order, when we get to Paris, we're going to see a lot of beautiful words from a lot of nations in the setting of the City of Light. But when they get down to it and they're across a table, what is going to be the stickiest one or two issues in front of them that haven't been prepared by diplomatic and scientific teams ahead of time?
Right. Well, I think that a big sticking point is finance. A lot of developing countries say we need money both to adapt to the inevitable climate change that's happening and also to take a different energy path, right? A cleaner, perhaps more expensive energy path. So the developed world did commit, in theory, $100 billion in climate finance, $100 billion a year. But we have seen pledges that do not total up to $100 billion yet, not nearly. The U.S., for example, has only committed $3 billion.
So let's say there's an agreement, as we probably expect coming out of Paris, and this agreement is brought home to the United States. What's the political battle that then ensues between the president and Congress?
Well, this is a key point. That agreement will not be brought home. It's what's called, once again, in wonderful UN speak, bindingness. What kind of a treaty are we going to get? We can't have a treaty that Barack Obama has to come home and get Senate ratification for, because he will not get it. It's sort of a treaty, but it's not a treaty that needs to be brought before Congress. And that is...
But as you talk, Betsy, yeah. imagine the listener hearing this, a treaty that's not a treaty, and they're all saying, you know what, I have a headache and I have to leave the room, but maybe I'll turn the lights off to be a good citizen. No, but I mean this. And it isn't this part of the problem?
Oh, absolutely.
In addition to the fact that we all have to change the way we live, the way we move around the globe, et cetera, et cetera, the political way this is discussed... And the intricacies of having to do it on an international level with countries having radically different interests make it so hard to get from point A to B when we have to get to Z.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is the situation that we're in. And it's, you know, it definitely a reasonable person could look at both the geophysics and, you know, the economics and the politics and despair. That is, I think, a very reasonable response. But that being said...
But we don't have to be religious to know that despair is the one unforgivable sin.
Exactly.
So when the politicians come home from Paris and you are assessing the meeting in Paris, what would you consider success and what would you consider a failure?
If we come out of Paris with a sort of agreement that emissions must peak soon and start coming down, that will be considered, you know, success. Now, does it mean emissions will peak soon and start to come down? I can't promise you that. But I think a sense that we have momentum and that therefore that we're heading in a certain direction. I know this sounds horribly vague and not enough to hang the future of the planet on, but I'm going to continue on anyway, that money will follow. The idea is that this will become a virtuous cycle. Money and investment will follow the direction and the signals given in Paris. That is the best you can hope for.
Betsy, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
That's New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Colbert. The Paris Climate Talks start on November 30th.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.